15. Let the time the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator Giesel. We are being served today by Senate Secretary Ann and audio guy, Thatcher, and committee aide is Ikey. So thanks very much for your help. Today we're going to start out with an overview of the topics of wetlands mitigation. This is an important topic. It's managed by the Department of Natural Resources and has tremendous impact on our development opportunities. And then we're going to take up Senate Bill 70, which is a right-of-way for a gas pipeline. So first of all, the wetlands overview. And for that, we have Sarah Longan present. Welcome, Sarah. Sarah's from the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for coming.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Sarah Longan, the Executive Director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting, or OPMP, in the Department of Natural Resources.
Excuse me, Sarah. My apologies. I also want to recognize that Senator Bishop has joined us. Welcome, Senator Bishop.
Way back there.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Thank you again for having me today. I will be discussing wetlands compensatory mitigation. Particularly, I'll be giving you an update on DNR's efforts to better understand the federal decision-making process, as well as evaluate the state's options to get more involved with wetlands mitigation. I am joined today for backup purposes by Director Michelle Hale from the Division of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation, as well as Director Tony DeGange from the Division of Habitat, Department of Fish and Game. While OPMP and DNR are leading the efforts to evaluate this process, we're doing that in full support and in coordination with our sister agencies.
Very good. I want to also welcome Senator Michicki, who has joined us. Welcome.
I want to start by giving a general overview over the federal regulations that require wetlands compensatory mitigation. You know that the Corps of Engineers is responsible for administering Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, and I am sure you've become very familiar with the 404 permit. It's one of the multiple and major permits necessary specifically to place fill into wetlands or waters of the U.S. In 2008, the EPA developed regulations commonly referred to as the Wetlands Mitigation Rule. The Corps of Engineers must comply with these regulations, and EPA maintains veto authority. For this specific regulatory process, I would be very surprised if EPA in Alaska has vetoed. While the Corps of Engineers leads this effort, it is in full consultation and coordination with EPA and other federal agencies. Project applicants go through great efforts to minimize impacts to wetlands and aquatic resources. They are required to produce aquatic site assessments. These were very recently referred to as wetlands functional analyses. It's this science that is very critical. The Corps of Engineers uses the information to determine the appropriate category of wetland impacts for purposes of assigning a mitigation ratio that can be translated into an in-lieu mitigation fee. And I'm going to break that down and more clearly describe that for you in just a moment. What we are hearing and observing in OPMP is that the regulatory guidance, particularly regarding the parameters necessary to fulfill these ASAs, have been changing over the last few years. We're also hearing and experiencing that total wetlands mitigation costs are increasing. And I'm going to provide you examples also in just one moment. So more about the federal rule. We know that project applicants must offset the unavoidable impacts to wetlands and aquatic resources. And there are various ways to achieve these mitigation goals. You can restore, enhance, create, or preserve wetlands someplace else to offset those impacts. Per the rule, there are three mechanisms to achieve these goals. Project applicants may use a mitigation bank or an in-lieu fee ILF program. The third option is for permittee responsible mitigation. Per the rule, it is required and preferred that these three preferences and options are conducted, the mitigation is conducted in the same watershed where the impacts are taking place.
Madam Chair? Yes, Senator Costello has a question.
Oh,
Thank you, Ms. Longin. So where in the process of NEPA and EIS does the discussion about the scope and the amount of the mitigation happen? Is it at the beginning? Where does that take place?
It's a great question, Senator Costello, through the chair, and I'll talk about it a little bit more in my presentation. But in our experience at DNR, the outcomes from compensatory mitigation requirements typically happens rather late in the process, quite honestly towards the end of NEPA evaluations. But I'll also address that in just a few slides.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we revert back to the previous page on enhancements and what might be some of the mitigators that might substitute for that in the Mat-Su Valley and other areas of the state? We've done extensive culvert repairs regarding fish habitat cleanup and through the capital budget, good or bad, we've put incredible resources into assisting on tsunami debris cleanup, which didn't even originate here. Are those comparable type activities that we have a case with the Corps, and do we have a way to establish any quantitative values of that?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, that's another great question. And the answer is that it's on a case-by-case basis, and it really is under the Corps of Engineers' purview in consultation with the EPA to make those determinations. I can share an update with you in terms of how DNR is better engaging and more consistently participating in those conversations, because we would tend to agree with you that culvert replacements or debris contamination site cleanup certainly should be an option to qualify for wetlands compensatory mitigation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm missing the link there. We're looking at this. Is this something that our state agency have been trying to engage? Where are they in the process of asking these questions? Do you need more assistance from some of the entities to put that case together? Do we have a coordination between our borough and state entities? And I'm not seeing the link. We say it's a good idea, but where's the nexus between the good idea and some type of action?
Sure. Senator Stoltz, through the chair, my presentation will be describing efforts underway at DNR to actually establish and seek our own approval from the Corps of Engineers to run our own mitigation program. I want to define some of those terms, walk you through some of the background, and then reveal to you what our plans are and what our hopes for future accomplishing goals are as well.
Go ahead, Sarah. Thank you.
So again, just for some continued definitions, a mitigation bank is a wetlands area that has been restored, established, enhanced, or preserved, then set aside to be used to offset unavoidable impacts. Upon approval, permittees purchase credits from these banks. These credits are established based on wetlands functions and number of acres restored. The mitigation bank sponsor is responsible for the success of the mitigation plan, and off-site mitigation is allowed.
Thank you, Sarah. I want to welcome Senator Sedman to committee. Thank you. Go ahead.
The in lieu fee program, what we call ILF, the permittee provides funds to a federally approved in lieu fee mitigation sponsor. And these entities are nonprofit or public agencies. The funds are used to build and maintain mitigation sites. Again, the success of the mitigation plan relies upon the ILF sponsor. Mitigation occurs off-site. The difference here is that mitigation occurs typically after a project is permitted. Permittee responsible is very straightforward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coghill.
Maybe get to it further down here, but as we go, the accountability on permit sponsor, not the permit, but the mitigation sponsor, because a lot of cash transacts, and it'd be kind of interesting to see if that really is an accountable transaction. So don't have to answer right now, but that's the first thing that comes to my mind as I read these.
Thank you. Lastly, permittee responsible. Again, there is an option for project applicants, the permittee, to develop and seek approval of their own mitigation plan. This can be done on-site or off-site. And just as a footnote here, OPUMP is hearing mainly from the mining companies, but perhaps others are impacted. Since the implementation of the 2008 rule, permittee responsible is seen is occurring much less often in Alaska. A mitigation ratio is an aggregate index used to calculate the gain and loss of wetlands to be adjusted based on the functions and qualities of those wetlands. And this is simple arithmetic, and perhaps this is what you've been hearing from current events, is that the higher the wetland mitigation ratios are, therefore, the greater number of acres are necessary for offset purposes. Therefore, also, there's the higher total mitigation cost. In Alaska, mitigation ratios typically range from 1 to 1, as high as 3 to 1, depending on wetland category and type of mitigation. Ratios for preservation, for example, will be set differently as for or in comparison to restoration or enhancement. I'm pretty sure you've probably heard of mitigation ratios being higher, maybe at set to 10 to 1. There's a list of factors that federal agencies may increase these mitigation ratios. That can include whether the wetlands being impacted or the aquatic resources are used to support a threatened or endangered species. If a federal agency deems those same resources as very rare, again, there's a list of criteria that can offer them the opportunity to have higher mitigation ratios.
Senator Coghill.
My understanding is those are more subjective. And how do you guys see it as DNR? It looks to me like they can be pushed pretty hard.
Senator Coghill, through the chair. Yes, and this was one of the reasons that really compelled DNR and particularly OPUMP just to pay closer attention to how these federal decisions were being made. That's why I can report to you that over in the last year and a half, OPUMP has gone through some pretty resource-intense efforts and activities to get more engaged with the federal agencies, because we do have some concerns when perhaps if subjective federal decisions are made that are increasing these ratios as high as 10 to 1 or even higher. We certainly want to understand what science is being used to make those determinations.
Follow up.
So are you going to, somewhere along the line, give us a criteria baseline for things that you'll be looking at in this mitigation process?
Senator Coghill, it certainly is an effort that we can take into consideration back home at DNR. We're pretty early on in this process. We have a lot more work ahead of us, but we want that to be effective, so that's actually a great recommendation. Thank you.
Senator Costello, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you. Sarah, so you're saying that these criteria, we're seeing a change, and I'm curious first where the authority first came from. Was it something passed by Congress? Or are we seeing another example where federal agencies are taking things into their own hands and essentially providing no voice for the states because of the nature of how they're making the change?
Senator Costello, through the chair, another great question. And that list of criteria in terms of what could require or require a federal agency to take into consideration increasing the mitigation ratio is actually listed in the 2008 federal rule.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'll try to, it's a tough one on how to phrase it, but we have 174 million acres roughly of wetlands in the state of Alaska. It's 30% of the state or something. Do they treat our wetlands differently than a state that is very highly developed, that has very few acres of wetlands remaining, or is there some credence to the comment that they're attempting to turn us into a giant park?
Senator Machicki, through the chair. It is DNR's observation that no, and I'm going to refer to a federal report that was created in 1994 that called out very specific, unique characteristics of our state that we believe the federal agencies have not been taking into consideration as they've made recent mitigation decisions. And it's a perfect...
Okay, Senator
Stoll. Just tagging on, Senator Machicki's question, is there any kind of index we can look at these formulas and ratios, and do they make sense? Is it objective and subjective question?
Senator Schultz, through the chair, you're asking all the best questions because this is all in my presentation. That's precisely what DNR wants to understand better. We've looked at ratios used in other states in the lower 48, and I'm going to report on how they make those determinations as well as how they establish fees.
Thank you.
Great. Senator Sedman, did you have a question?
All right. Yes, Madam Chairman. During your presentation, too, I know there's a lot of big projects with large impacts, but there's small individual subdivisions that people are doing around the communities, and I've had a lot of complaints from my constituents, guys going into 4 or 5 acres and trying to put some trailers in there, or houses, what have you, and they run into the mitigation issue where they're losing large, very large chunks of their land that they paid for. So through your presentation, maybe you can try to touch on the smaller guys too, along with the bigger ones. I know.
Be happy to.
It'd be appreciated.
Thank you.
Great, and I do want to welcome Senator Wanikowski. Thank you.
So I want to spend a little bit of time describing how the 2008 mitigation rule, it's difficult to implement in our state. When the current federal no-net loss policy was being developed, and that policy simply states that where there is an impact, there shall be no net loss of wetlands and aquatic resources. You are very familiar with the fact that wetlands are so highly ubiquitous in our state. We're also very different in that we are not experiencing a rapid decline of our wetlands, as was the case in the lower 48 when the 2008 mitigation rule was being developed. This is why the federal agencies were compelled to produce a report back in 1994, the Alaska Wetlands Initiative, that described the unique characteristics of Alaska's wetlands. This report concluded that a flexible regulatory approach was necessary, emphasizing practicability and flexibility of the regulatory program to help reflect these circumstances in Alaska. And this initiative is not currently in effect. As was stated earlier, we all realize, and here's a map showing, anytime you see something green, it's wet. 174 million acres, 43% of Alaska's surface area. This should be the right kind of problem to have, right? But in this context, it's not. And it's because there are limited available lands eligible for wetlands compensatory mitigation. Per the rule, wetlands can only qualify to be used for mitigation if there's an imminent threat to them. Because of our pristine nature and small inventory of previously disturbed wetlands in Alaska, it is difficult to have enough wetlands credits eligible and compliant with the rule. Other limiting factors unique to our state, you're probably pretty well aware that there's only one federally approved in-lieu-fee compensatory mitigation program sponsor for projects proposed on the Arctic Slope, right where we see obviously a lot of oil and gas and resource development activities. The ILF program sponsors must produce what they call an instrument. This is a report describing their methodologies in terms of how they are to manage their ILF program. This report is submitted to the Corps of Engineers, ultimately for their approval. Some of the Alaska ILF programs will disclose what their cost per acres include. Some examples of cost per acre credits in Alaska can range from $44,000 per acre up to $125,000, the larger number more typically seen in southeast portions of the state. These costs are established solely by the ILF program sponsor, and they are driven by the type of wetland, the value, and the geographic area. OPUMP has taken some time to investigate what other ILF programs are like in lower 48 states, and we readily admit that the costs I'm showing here are sometimes much smaller than what states like New Jersey or Florida or others are charging. They can have very high cost per credit acres. But what OPUMP and DNR are hearing from the operators is that it's collectively an increase of the mitigation ratios as well as significant costs per acres that makes it certainly burdensome in Alaska, and it's due to the size that we're so big, the fact that we're so big. We know that there's very little existing infrastructure in some regions of our state. So the proximal distance for our project applicants to get to their project site, all of these factors, again, collectively, the operators and the companies are saying there's a concern that these mitigation costs run the risk of placing a once commercially viable project perhaps no longer economically feasible. And while we do have a small number of existing ILF programs and mitigation banks, I just wanted to share that there are 3 ILF programs and 1 is being proposed. There are 5 mitigation banks and 4 being proposed actually in Alaska currently.
Question. Senator Costello.
Thank you. And Sarah, it's my understanding that as part of the mitigation effort, ConocoPhillips and the Moose's Tooth Project, is being required to mitigate what we in Alaska call travesty wells, which are solely the responsibility and cause of the federal government. Is this the first time we're seeing a private company being required to mitigate on federally owned land?
Senator Costello, through the chair, in OPUMP's experience and in my personal experience, it certainly was the first case that we were made aware of a project applicant having a requirement to mitigate the oil legacy well programs. And it is my understanding, and perhaps my knowledge and information is old, that that was something considered for the Greater Moose's Tooth Project, and it was something that might have been sort of placed on hold as BLM is now undertaking the effort to develop an NPRA regional mitigation plan. I'm thankful for the question, because I want to provide an underscore here that what we're talking about today is a very specific regulatory function, and this is for wetlands compensatory mitigation. Equally important, and what happens through the NEPA process, as I'm sure you're very familiar with, is there's sort of what I call the capital M mitigation. Project applicants are mitigating for all other sources of impacts, whether it's to subsistence, to wildlife, to air quality impacts. And what we saw, DNR could report, going through the Greater Moose's Tooth NEPA and permitting process, is those two, the big letter M mitigation and the wetlands compensatory mitigation, were sort of getting conjoined in a way where DNR perhaps, or at least OPUMP, I can say, perhaps felt that, for a lack of a better way to describe it, some double dipping was occurring. And we raised our concerns to BLM, and they took the time to listen to our arguments. But it's probably another reason why DNR is wanting to get more involved, and we have recommendations for the state to get involved with mitigation.
Thank you.
Senator Machiki, did you have a question?
I did. It's from kind of a couple slides back. But just on patented land, pre-section 404 of the Clean Water Act, on private land, has anyone litigated the compensatory program as a taking anywhere in the U.S.?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, it's a great question, and I don't know. I have not, nor have my office, heard of that occurring, but we can certainly look into it and get back with you.
Senator Stedman.
Senator Machiki's question kind of rolls into this one. There was a mention earlier that there's the mitigation banks. There's several in the state, several more in application process or whatever. I'd like to have the department come back with those lists to us, unless it's somewhere in your presentation, because there is an interest in changing the status of that, if we can. And to the point that Senator Machiki had brought up, at least in my area of the state, the people I represent that do subdivisions of 5 acres or 4 acres or what have you, because we don't have a lot of land, since the rainforest, don't have the capital to litigate this. So, frankly, it's viewed as an extortion fee. And it'd also be nice to have a brief virtual extortion fee, I should say. That's the I've had more than one of my constituents reference it to that. It'd be nice to have a little update on what happens to the private person with patented land that inadvertently or inadvertently breaches this. And I think the public would be rather surprised at the consequences. And just a quick note, it'd be nice in the presentation if you always use in lieu fee program, so the people at home know exactly what we're talking about. They write a check, mm-hmm. rather than the acronym. Because the presentation is for the public.
Senator, to step in through the chair. Thank you. And again, I am not readily familiar with the information you're seeking, but we'd be happy to investigate that further and follow up with you and the committee.
Thanks. You can actually send anything to my office, and we'll distribute it to the committee. Thank you.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. So as OPUMP was hearing a little bit more and more from mining companies or oil and gas companies, we know that there is a cost to the large companies, the private sector, and as has been referenced from this committee, that it is impacting the individual citizens also, simply trying to build a dock on their property or trying to do something for their small business. OPUMP and DNR are also very well aware that this has a cost to the state-funded projects and the state project applicants. I have some examples of what state revenues are being used for mitigation banking, but this does not cover or capture the whole picture. We do know that DOT has paid an estimated $8.3 million since 2009 into banks and ILF programs for statewide airport, highway, and maintenance projects. The railroad, an estimated $2 million since 2000. But we know that the university, the Trust Land Office, AGDC, and other state or quasi-state agencies are paying these high mitigation fees also. We also know that presently proposed projects and future projects in the state that are state-funded, of course they're going to have to acquire the 404 permit, but they should be planning that the wetlands mitigation costs are going to be a significant total project cost.
Senator Stedman.
I should know this, but I don't. The Native Corporation's lands, they come under the 404 permit process also?
Senator Sidman, through the chair, yes, sir. So approximately a year and a half ago, OPUMP was asked to really creatively think about the problem and to identify certain goals for solutions. We asked ourselves, how can DNR or how can anyone among the state government get more involved with wetlands mitigation? A limiting factor, as has already been recognized by this committee, is that so few lands in Alaska are privately owned. However, you are all very familiar with the fact that here shown in blue areas, the state owns and manages a very large portfolio of acreage throughout the state. So I've spent a fair amount of time describing the challenges, why the 2008 mitigation rule, it's tricky for the Corps of Engineers to implement in our state. But I want to take a moment to really describe that we have an opportunity here, that DNR in full partnership and collaboration with state agencies have an opportunity. Where we have questioned the federal agencies, if they are actually considering Alaska's unique circumstances as the 1994 report called upon them to do, I do want to underscore that we went straight to the Corps of Engineers and we asked them questions, and we asked them suitability and implementation, and they've been very supportive, and they've actually been taking a lot of time to walk us through the process. So back home, we are working to collaborate with the Corps to identify and develop an Alaska-specific wetlands compensatory mitigation program. We are learning from the Corps the requirements necessary for perhaps DNR to develop a prospectus, submit it to the Corps of Engineers, and seek approval to run a state-managed umbrella in-lieu fee program. In order to do this, DNR has a fair amount of work ahead of us. We must inventory our state lands. We have to go to the Corps of Engineers with the best science and information available. We can do that by using multi-layered screening criteria, using GIS audit, developed in collaboration with mitigation specialists. They know the type of science and the information we need to collect. One thing that OPUMP has been doing again over the last year and a half, as well as being supported by DEC and Fish and Game participation, the federal agencies have had a statewide interagency review team, and this is the group that evaluates the existing IRT and in-lieu fee program and mitigation banks that are seeking approval. This has paid in pretty significant dividends. It has allowed OPUMP, DNR, and other state agencies a seat at the table when those conversations are being had. Senator Costello, you asked earlier about the NEPA process. As soon as OPUMP was learning more about the compensatory wetlands mitigation process, we realized, as you know, OPUMP typically enters into cooperating agency status with the federal agencies. So we're a part of the NEPA conversation throughout. But we never heard about the specific regulatory function making decisions about wetlands compensatory mitigation. Here again, I want to thank the Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Land Management, because in this example, OPUMP suggested, why don't we have the conversation as part of NEPA? And in fact, for the Greater Moose's Tooth Project, that occurred. The federal agencies allowed that to happen, and again, OPUMP saw dividends almost immediately just by being part of that conversation. Sort of part of everyday business back at home at DNR, and I know also at DEC and Fish and Game, the state tries to partner with the federal government where it makes sense to perhaps develop a general permit. Companies have been asking for more consistency in wetlands compensatory mitigation. Where we haven't achieved this goal of developing a GP that accomplishes that, I think we should all be encouraged that at least the federal and state agencies are having the conversation. I discussed a major part of seeking approval from the Corps of Engineers will be an inventory of state lands. This is simply a screenshot of some of the ongoing efforts to do mapping back in DNR. We're using sophisticated state-of-the-art tools to map areas of the state, whereas just a few handful of years ago, they weren't adequately mapped. This is going to be a key part if we are to be successful in seeking approval from the Corps to develop an NLUFI program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coghill.
Just on the GIS programming and on the federal government participation, have they been doing any GIS mapping on their available and open lands, most specifically BLM lands and maybe some of the forestry lands? Do you know if they've been doing any of their calculating?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I'm aware that mapping is taking place among the federal agencies, particularly BLM. I don't have specific examples of how much progress they've made on any given parcel of federal land.
Yes, follow up.
Do they have, under their wetlands mitigation on federal lands, what are the ratios that they're lending to? Are they more generous? Are they more tight-fisted? What's the expectation from what should we know about that?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, it's a great question, and I will admit that as of about 2 years ago, certainly OPUMP wasn't aware, and it's these things that we need to continue to learn while participating on the state interagency review team. And to my knowledge, there are certainly restoration projects that take place on federal lands, but my assumption, and I could be wrong, and I can follow up with the committee also, is that the mitigation is utilizing private lands for preservation purposes. I don't know how much active mitigation banking per se is taking place on federal lands.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking is because I knew there was private land pressure, and outside of the native corporations, we're down to the less than 2% of Alaska. So that's taking things off the table that we can't afford to get off the table. So if the federal government is doing that, it would be important for us as the state legislators to know that has a huge impact.
Yes, Senator Stedman.
Senator Coghill's comment, and I keep bringing it down to the small guys because we've got small guys in my district, and we're not dealing with the gas line, which is a whole other set of problems dealing with this. But we had one of my communities went in and did a subdivision several years ago, got it three-quarters of the way done, and then there was some skunk cabbage in a newspaper, and this is no, and I'm not complaining about the Corps because they actually have been good to work with it, so it's the dictate from out of Washington that we're struggling with here. So they were well underway in their subdivision, and then there was skunk cabbage in the newspaper, this pretty subdivision going in, and you know what hit the fan, and then it came to a screeching halt. So in that case, you had a community. This was Sitka, actually. A fairly good-sized community that should be sophisticated enough to not blunder into something like this. There was a contractor that in Petersburg that went in and did a little subdivision, bought some land, 7 acres or 6 acres or whatever, just punched a road down there to chop it up and I think 4 pieces or something like that, and didn't realize that he was required to have a 404 permit and dealing with the, he'd been dealing with City Hall, got his road down and his layout down, and then all of a sudden, the issue arose. And it's rather unpleasant, and I think it would be nice when we have a presentation on the penalties and what happens under this. In another case, a guy went in and did a subdivision. You know, these are guys that have been doing it for 30 years. So we're not talking about somebody that's, just buy some properties, never done anything before, and going to chop it up and thinks he's going to make a killing. These guys that have been in the business for their entire career goes in and starts the process of putting in a subdivision of about a dozen lots. This was in Sitka. And got into it and then realized that, he needed this 404 permit, wetlands issue. I'm aware of these because my phone rings, in fact, on both of these. you know, and the guy's sweating bullets trying to figure out how he's going to deal with this. And frankly, my advice to him was, do what you're told or you're going to be put out of business and probably end up in jail. So that's your choice. And there's not much I could do about it because it's, you know, it's being driven out of Washington. So it is a serious matter. It's just been one of these issues that have been under the table that we haven't dealt with here. But as Senator Coghill said, we have such little land, private land in the state, we can't afford to take any more off the table. And we're going to be forced to under this. So anyway, I just thought I'd put my two cents in here. I get kind of fired up on this issue, as you'll see as we get into it.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Senator Stedman. I mean, that's the purpose of bringing this to the surface and talking about it here on Resources. We know it's a significant issue. I'll let you continue, sir.
Thank you. Nearly there. I believe that there's a way that DNR and the state can help. We can at least offer options to wetlands compensatory mitigation, and we have things working in our favor. For example, the 2008 federal rule listed the advantages of having nonprofit and government agencies act as third-party mitigation sponsors for the simple fact that profit isn't driving our necessity to run these programs. And in fact, I'd like to say that DNR was the first one to have this good idea, but we weren't. 31 of the lower 48 states are already involved in mitigation. 25 run mitigation banks, 12 states run in-lieu fee programs. DEC has been taking advantage of grant opportunities, EPA's wetland program development grant funding, albeit the grant amounts are small. They won't be enough to cover all of the efforts necessary for the state to seek approval to run an in-lieu fee program, but it's helpful yet still. Qualified recipients can receive grant money to develop a comprehensive monitoring and assessment program, improve the effectiveness of compensatory mitigation, or refine the protection of vulnerable wetlands and aquatic resources. These are very important principles to DNR, and I know that these are the same important principles shared by our counterparts at DEC and Fish and Game. OPOMP has been busy, but we have a lot more work to do. We've been engaged in a pretty robust stakeholder outreach. We want to understand how this is impacting the little guys. We feel like we have a good sense of how it's impacting the larger scale resource developments, but we want to spend more time talking to stakeholders. We also want to continue the conversation, talking with people who are already involved with wetlands mitigation banking, looking for areas for potential partnership opportunities.
Good. Senator Stedman.
I've got one question and just a quick comment. I can tell you how,
Madam Chairman, I can tell you how two of my constituents feel about it. They're not going to subdivide and do it anymore. It's not worth the headaches. It's just that simple. It's an absolute nightmare. If you're Exxon, you know, you've got the ability to go through the process and hire lawyers and staff to deal with it. If you're, you know, Joe Public, you and your wife or your spouse, you don't have the capital. So, but back on this issue, this bullet point on slide 13, second bullet point, do any of those states have, like they have 25 run mitigation, what I'd like to see us do is have all the mitigation banks with the state. So we are the sole holder, the state of Alaska, because this will probably hopefully evolve in the future to morph into something else, who knows 100 years from now or 50 years from now. But have the state hold that, all of it. And also, look at the feasibility of absorbing the current ones. And as far as the payment program, have the state involved in the payment program too, and we can talk about what we do with the payments, the monies received. But I think the public, the citizens of the state of Alaska, should own that land and control it. And if the federal government insists that it stays in the way Mother Nature made it 10,000 years ago and the way it is today, so be it. But we should be the ones holding it, the state.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I can offer just one comment. When OPOMP investigated programs in the lower 48 states, we do not recall witnessing or observing where a state sort of maintained the control over all existing mitigation banker and LUFI programs. My recollection is where the state was involved in lower 48 states, there were very likely other privately owned in LUFI or mitigation banks, but I'm certainly not saying that it couldn't happen that way, but based on our research, that is what we found.
Senator Coghill.
It just occurs to me that with somewhere around, or at least less than 2% of private property in Alaska, my guess is the native lands are going to be dealing with trust lands issues. And coming our way is waters of the United States issues. And the way I describe that, it's the timber line. That's what they want. And that means everything in Alaska is going to be under that control. So my first expectation is when it comes to federal land, that are they going to put that into private holdings? And then if they're not going to do that, why should we follow into private hands? Why can't we keep the state under the, keep the title under the sub and maybe have that wetland agreement? So is that a good enough example with the federal government?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, yes, and it's really a good thing to point out, and it's something that, again, I feel confident that the state can raise that interest, perhaps, to the Corps of Engineers, and so far they've been collaborating with us to actually help us achieve those goals. So in this process, again, I think you can tell that we're really early on in the process, but we want to hear this information. We want to hear the feedback from stakeholders, concerned citizens, and understand the options that we have to develop a program that might help solve some of these problems.
Senator Coghill.
One of the questions you might ask the Corps is if they have taken lands into mitigation that have gone outside of their watershed. Because one of the things we're going to find interesting in Alaska is everything is greenfield in Alaska, and how to stay within a single watershed area is going to be very, very difficult. So their own study might show that there has to be some flexibility there. And so as you find this out, that's one of the questions I'd direct you to ask.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Stoltz.
Madam Chair, not a question as much as a very quick comment. I always hate it when the state of Alaska or anybody else uses the term stakeholders. These are usually parties that want to be part of your business decisions and your business without putting a single bit of their own skin in the game. We have a stakeholder in our Max Matsu projects, a fellow named Bob Shavelson from Homer, who's probably added $8-9 million worth of cost through federal litigation, including that. I almost hate it when the state of Alaska gives them credence and credibility. I wish we'd call them like meddling miscreants or something like that. I just, it's editorial, Madam Chair, but it's a frustration level.
Thank you very much, Senator Stoltz.
And I can close very quickly.
Senator Costello.
Thank you. One final question, Sarah. So I wanted to get back to the question of mapping, and it seems that the state's efforts to map Alaska will affect this, and just having that information. Do you have any status on the duration that it would take to map and the cost? And I know this might not be in OPUMP's purview entirely, but do you have any information you can provide on that?
Sure. Senator Costello, through the chair, I can speak to most of that. In terms of the process, the length of time it would take for what we believe the state could be successful in pursuing approval to run an in-LUFI program, using the mapping information that we currently have, Senator Costello, we believe that we can have this process closed out within the next 2 years. If we continue to stay on the path that we've already set out to stay on, we could have a prospectus submitted to the Corps of Engineers within the 6 to 8 months.
Follow-up?
Wow, yes, follow-up.
And Sarah, in our current budget environment, is that timeline achievable?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I guess I will answer that by describing the funding that OPUMP has had to date that has made the efforts to date possible. As you know, I believe that you realize that OPUMP receives program receipt money, and we receive funds from outside sectors. It's the project applicants who have a predominant concern in terms of these increasing mitigation costs, and we're doing well with those funding. We have not secured funding for the next fiscal year, but I'm confident that I can devise a plan to continue to have the necessary funding to continue down our path. I just wanted to leave you with some very interesting and helpful references. If you have not yet read the 1994 Wetlands Initiative Report, I encourage you to do so. It's really an interesting read. Before I close, I wanted to point out my Deputy Director, Jeff Bruno. He and I have been working closely together, again, in full support and coordination with our sister agencies. I'll leave you with our contact information. If you have any follow-up questions that have not come up today, please do not hesitate to call. With that, I'll close, and I'll be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Chair.
Excellent. I appreciate your presentation, Ms. Longham. Yes, Senator Coghill.
First of all, there's many things in here that help me with my understanding. Working with Senator Bishop, we've been trying to figure out a way to encourage the state recipient of the lands in mitigation, whether we do it through private mechanisms or public mechanisms, I'm open to discussion on. But I think you're going to get some, at least communication to you from the Senate this year. It would be my expectation. So I guess the question I have for you is, we probably better have a better understanding of what the federal government does with their own lands before we start asking you to do things that you're in the middle of negotiating on. So. I would ask you to prepare to talk with Senator Bishop on this, because he's been talking about it for months now, and I think that's one thing that has to be framed better. So, what's your time frame of understanding on that federal management of their own lands?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, we can get that information to you very quickly. And Senator Bishop has been very interested in the topic. I thank him for his interest. OPUMP is more than happy to continue to answer Senator Bishop's or anyone else's questions on this matter.
All right. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Sedman.
Just to, Madam Chairman, just to follow up on that offer on data, if it's available, could I get the cost for the Southeast region?
Senator Sedman, through the chair, yes, we can work to get you those estimates.
And both public and private.
Senator Sedman, it might take a little while, but we will be more than happy to look into it for you.
Madam Chairman, I think it would be an eye-opening experience to see what it costs our municipalities and then what it costs our private citizens.
I agree, Senator Sedman. And I think that Ms. Longham's division here is this office is underappreciated and for the work that they do. So I really appreciate your presentation, and if the opportunity arises, we'll have you back again, perhaps to answer more in-depth questions. So thank you very much for your presentation, and thank you, Mr. Bruno, for being here as well.
Thank you.
Great. All right. So speaking of wetlands and right-of-way, our next bill is Senate Bill 70. This is a bill introduced by the governor that provides additional right-of-way for a gas pipeline. We have with us today a large number of people. I'm going to invite Ben Ellis, Director of the Division of Parks and Recreation, to come to the table. I believe Don Perrin, Acting Director of the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, is going to join you as well. Is that correct? Mr. Ed Fogles, DNR Deputy Commissioner, is present in the room. On the phone, just so Mr. Ellis knows, we have Wynn Menefee, Chief of Operations, Division Mining, Land, and Water, Frank Richards, AGDC, Mike Thompson, AGDC, Miles Baker, AGDC, and Jeff Lepo, AGDC. So lots of lifelines out there. So welcome, Director Ellis. I will let you go ahead and begin. If you would present the bill and the detailed information about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Ben Ellis, Director of Alaska State Parks and Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. We appreciate the opportunity to present SB 70. This will allow the a gas line to go through Alaska State Parks, four of them that have been identified. You know, when parks, and I'll give you a 35,000 foot view, and then I'm going to have Don kind of drill in some areas. When recreational land has been pulled out of the general state land, the multi-purpose use has been replaced by a specific use, and that in this case would be recreation. Because of the difference between Title 38 land, land that is in general state land, and that is administered by our sister division of mining, land, and water, and that of Title 41 land, which are state park lands, is that I do not have the ability to do any type of long-term lease on Title 41 land. The concept is that of short periods of time, 4 or 5 years, to allow, say, a concession to come in to occupy an area. But it's not designed, Title 41 is not designed for long-term leasing that the right-of-way of a pipeline would need. So this particular bill addresses that and allows the commissioner and the four units that are mentioned to be used in a right-of-way situation, and then it will still be managed for park intent. We can talk about that later. But that's the purpose. That's why we're here. And I'm going to turn over some of the specifics to what the bill will do to Don Perrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Don Perrin, for the record, and I am the acting state pipeline coordinator within the Department of Natural Resources. As Ben said, the intent of this bill is to allow for a pipeline corridor through the Denali State Park and three identified state recreational areas that are all under Title 41 that were legislatively designated. to kind of look at it at a higher level, the state pipeline coordinators issued a 3835 right-of-way lease to AGDC in 2011. Presently, it is a discontinuous lease because of these Title 41 lands. And so quite simply, this bill would allow us to apply the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and thereby have like a contiguous 3835 right-of-way lease through state lands. If I could just speak to a couple of the primary objectives of the bill. As I said, it authorizes the right-of-way lease under 3835, the Pipeline Right-of-Way Leasing Act. It requires that the corridor be managed as parkland and recreation areas until leased under 3835 and then returned to parkland and recreational areas upon termination of the lease. It also provides supplemental requirements to reserve traditional means of public access and minimize the impact of the pipeline on specific values of the park and recreation areas. And what I mean by that is that the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office would work with Division of Parks to formulate and establish stipulations and requirements of the lease that are intended to protect the park values of those areas. And it also clarifies that the DNR's commissioner's power to delegate condemnation authority to the lessee, that does not apply within the bounds of these park areas. It currently does not apply within Denali State Park. This would basically clarify that point. In other words, we cannot condemn this land for a pipeline. And finally, it would require that the gas pipeline lease be issued before January 1st, 2020. And those are the primary objectives that the bill would accomplish. I would toss it back to Mr. Ellis to describe as to why the bill is needed.
Again, Ben Ellis, Director of Alaska State Parks. Madam Chair, as I mentioned earlier, this bill is needed. So there can be a right-of-way lease through, and let me name the four state park units, Denali State Park and the recreational areas of Willow Creek, Nancy Lake, and Captain Cook State Park. You have maps, I believe, in the presentation. I've also brought larger maps that I can leave that the committee can look at?
Of the various areas, this would be Denali State Park, where it goes through it towards Nancy Lake, and with Willow Creek Recreational Site. We'll leave these. The one that we don't have that I still have coming is the Captain Cook one that's on the Kenai Peninsula. I think we have a small version of that in your packet of what the large map would look like. We'll leave those with the committee to use as you see fit. Yes,
we actually have some fairly large ones.
Yeah, okay, good.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, Don?
So, Madam Chair, if I could just finalize with two additional discussion topics, and that is one might ask why this bill doesn't include the state game refuges. Mm-hmm. It is our belief that the 3835 Right-of-Way Leasing Act does apply in those areas, and therefore we have not included those in this bill. And permitting for geotechnical work and other field work that will support the final application as being conducted in those areas as well. So we didn't feel, after we had the discussion with our Department of Law, that we needed to include the state game refuges, as it was our belief that those areas are already allowed for the 3835 Right-of-Way Leasing Act. And so we held the bill specific to the areas in question here. Finally, we needed to speak on the fact that we have two gas line projects. We have the ASAP and we have the AKLNG. This corridor that would be created through this bill is basically what would be granted to ADDC upon which time we review their amended application. So a little bit of history. In 2012, the Corps of Engineers finalized their EIS for the right-of-way that was applied for by the department. We granted the right-of-way. That right-of-way essentially followed the DOT right-of-way along the Denali Highway, but because it was Title 41 lands, we determined that the Right-of-Way Leasing Act didn't apply there. Later in 2013, 2014, the AKLNG project came into our world, and so those engineers for both those projects are working together, at least in terms of the geotech work that is needed for the right-of-way, and by geotech I mean they're drilling core holes to assess the underlying soils and come up with the best right-of-way. So while it is a little early for AKLNG to finalize a right-of-way, this corridor, we believe, will suffice for both projects, and we believe it will suffice for any gas line project. So it's not specific to ASAP or AKLNG. It's the likely corridor that either of those pipelines would traverse through. And both those projects are currently conducting field work along that corridor to gather information that would support an application at some point.
Thank you. You clarified something, Mr. Perrin, and that is that they currently are able to do drill holes.
Yes, ma'am.
In these areas. Okay.
Yes.
Great. Good. That's important clarification. Good.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that. I issued a director's determination a week ago to allow the drilling, and the permit was issued last Friday, I believe. We had a organizational meeting of those that would be out in the field. Actually, I think it issued on Thursday. We had a meeting on Friday in the office with those that were going to be in the field. It's my understanding that this Wednesday will be the first work that will be out in the field. We'll have staff there to monitor the work as it gets started.
Good. Questions, committee members? Yes, Senator Walikowski.
Yeah, thank you. In your discussions with
the producers, BP, Conoco, Exxon, and TransCanada, how confident are you that this is the line that they will, that they're planning on building? This is the route, I mean.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. Our confidence level is based on the field work that is currently occurring. We won't know what the final alignment is until FERC has completed their process for AKLNG.
Yes, follow-up, Senator
Wilkowski. In timing, is it better to pass this now or is it better to wait?
Our hope would be that if we could pass it now, it will be enough land that will accommodate either project.
So just in following up with Senator Wilkowski's question, you have a specific line drawn on these maps, and yet the companies are currently out doing drilling, or will be, right, to determine geotechnical data. What if the line moves? How much wiggle room is there?
Madam Chair, there is a significant amount of wiggle room. However, you are correct in that the Corps of Engineers, through their EIS, supplemental EIS, for the ASAP project, and FERC, through the AKLNG project, could end up with a line other than what's being represented at this point. It is our belief that we have enough wiggle room to accommodate that.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. How large is the easement that it would be getting on each side of the pipeline? So, I mean, just looking at page 1 of the bill, section line 13 and line 14, you're talking section 4N1/2 southwest, I guess that's north one half, southwest one half. Can you give me a little context what that means, how big of a space we're talking about?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, would I be able to ask Frank Richards with AGDG to answer that question?
Certainly. Mr. Richards, can you hear us on the phone, and would you like Senator Wilkowski to repeat his question?
Madam Chairman, for the record, Frank Richards, it would be helpful to hear the Senator's question.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe for those of us who are survey challenged, you could just give us one example. Page 1, line 13, for instance, says section 4. I assume that's north one half, southwest one half. Maybe I'm saying that wrong, but how big of a space is that?
Go ahead. So, Madam Chairman, this is Mike Thompson. I'm the Environmental Regulatory and Lands Manager for ASAP. And through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, the way we develop these sections of land for the pipeline alignment is we looked at our original right-of-way, which is 53 feet. We have that's the operational right-of-way. The construction right-of-way is 120 feet. So we're looking at 120 feet of land for our purposes for both construction and operation. We put on both sides of that a 300-foot buffer. So now we have a 720-foot corridor, if you will, surrounding the center line. And any quarter section that touched that buffer, in addition, any quarter section within 300 feet of that buffer was incorporated into the corridor that we're discussing right now. So a quarter section is about 1,320 feet by 1,320 feet. So this is a fairly significant buffer. We've run this through the engineering team here at ASAP and ensured that it would meet their needs. So that's what you have before you.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
So where I read page 1, section 4, and north one-half, southwest one-half, we're talking how many feet, how many square feet, or how many linear feet?
Well, the quarter, acres. Excuse me, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the quarter section would be 1320 by 1320. So a lot of that would depend on where the center line touched that particular quarter section. But at minimum, the project has a 720-foot buffer surrounding the center line.
So that was Mr. Thompson, correct, as the speaker?
Yes, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Sure. If you could, on the phone, just identify yourself. It would help our recording secretary. Thank you. Senator Wachowski, further follow-up? Okay. Senator Machicki.
Just to follow up, I think it would help all of us. You know, what you could do, perhaps through the chair, maybe is present us with a map that shows the alignment. In this case, of course, in this project, we talk a lot about alignment. You mean it as a civil engineering term for where the pipeline will be going. But perhaps a map that has the various sections and adjacent sections that are included in this somehow highlighted. I think that will help clarify the amount of room that you have on either side of the line.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we're working on that, and I hope to have that by this week at some point. We'll get it to the chair.
Very good. Senator Costello.
Thank you, and I appreciate that information and wanted to follow up with sort of what Senator Wilikowski's question highlighted, which is we don't usually get bills like this, and so in a way we're sort of taking your word for, all of page 2 and page 3 in terms of specifically what area we're talking about, and I know that, of course, we have experts all over the place in state government, but I just wanted to say that with a bill actually reaching the governor's desk in the recent past in the expansion of the Creamers Field in Fairbanks, what have we learned from that exercise, and what assurance does the legislature have in this type of legislation that has huge significance for the state? Not that the Creamers Field doesn't, but that this legislation would have significant impact, and we want to make sure we get it right. So if you could respond to that.
Senator Costello.
That's okay.
I guess I want to say Mia, apologize for that to the chair.
You can call me Mia. Yeah. Fine.
It's an excellent question, and an excellent question because of the Creamers Field issue, and Parks was involved in that as well. The House Wickersham was on part of that bill that would make it a lieutenant governor's residence, and it was ended up vetoing because the description was incorrect. I think my only response at this point, and I think Don or others can chime in, this is the description that we feel comfortable and we feel assured with. But I think there has already been comments that there may be modifications to it.
So could I ask, Mr. Richards is on the phone with AGDC. I guess I would kind of like to hear from him what involvement they had in these parcels that are defined here. Mr. Richards, could you express your level of confidence that this is actually accurate descriptions of these pieces of property?
Yes, Madam Chairman, for the record, Frank Richards. The land descriptions that you see under Section 1 actually came from AGDC, as was described by Mike Thompson. And the reason why we're comfortable with this is we felt that it provided, again, a sufficient amount of area to be able to make modifications as we work with our partners now with AKLNG on our common alignment. And through this area, we have been discussing, and AGDC for the ASAP project has landed on this alignment as a workable right-of-way. And then I believe that our AKLNG is also in the review process for this right now with their routing engineers and going through their formal process. But we felt that the land as defined in Section 1 would be sufficient.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Can you, 720 feet, how does that compare to the TAPS buffer and TAPS easement, I guess?
I think I'm 100 foot.
Question for Mr. Richards, Senator Wilikowski? I'm thinking probably,
yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Whoever.
Madam Chairman, I would like Mike Thompson to answer that question.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Mike Thompson, for the record. Senator Wilikowski, the TAPS I believe, had a 600-foot construction easement, and they operate under a 100-foot right-of-way easement on state lands.
Sufficient? Or Senator Walikowski, follow-up?
So I see there's a provision there that public access would be allowed on that easement. It looks like obviously a lot of this is going through state parks, areas where people go and recreate and hunt and fish. I assume there's going to be access allowed through this corridor?
Through the chair, Senator Walikowski, you're correct. We would look at managing the project in sort of a spatial temporal time frame as far as when there would be the fewest amount of folks. There's about 325,000 acres in at least in Denali State Park alone. We would envision working so that it would have the least minimal impact in the area, but it would still be open for people to cross or to go over. Much of this is very close to the right-of-way of the highway. We're not talking about very far into the park. So I believe that through our stipulations, we could mitigate and manage that.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. And for the record, that was Mr. Ellis, Director Ellis speaking. If you could identify yourself, it does help, Ann.
Madam Chair.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Machicki.
Just, Mr. Ellis, you may just cover on page 4, line 9. It talks about how uses are reserved in the bill for typical use. Just covers it right in the bill as opposed to leaving it up to right-of-way law.
Thank you. Senator Costello, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. And you had mentioned, Mr. Ellis, that you were anticipating changes, and I was hoping you could clarify that because I didn't know if you meant this legislation allows for changes or that it could change. And then in line with that, I know that Representative Tallarico and the other body has introduced legislation germane to this. And have you reviewed that, and can you tell the committee what the differences are between the legislation before the legislature here?
Senator Costello, through the chair. Ben Ellis, Director of State Parks. My comment earlier was in a small sense of movement. In other words, the right-of-way line that we see here, I am sure will not be the right-of-way line, but I'm very confident that would it be within the right-of-way easement of the 750 feet that we would be, granting through this. So that was where my comment was as far as I expect change. But the bill does not address change past the width of the corridor. Concerning HB 139, we began reviewing that on Friday. I believe it was the first time that I saw the bill. We're not in a position at this time to give a comparison, although that is something that we know that we need to do. We're working on that, and once we have the review, I'd be more than happy to send it to the chair, and the chair can distribute it.
Very good. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ben Ellis of Parks, I know he's going to be cautious about describing the other legislation. Just right your first blush. It has a couple of issues that are ancillary to the pipeline, but important issues dealing with Title 41 and things that you have your hands tied on. Do you think they have any kind of inimical or de minimis effect on this whole process? Do you want a poison pill? And how much more poison can you take?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, Ben Ellis. One of the largest differences that I can see offhand, and that's already been mentioned, is that it includes House Bill 139 includes refuges within the description. Now, I would have to defer to either a Fish and Game or law as to whether that needs to be in there or should be in there or not. But that is definitely one of the biggest differences. I haven't been able to go through on the section lines of exactly where this corridor is for 139. To me, that would be another analytical point that needs to be looked at. I'm not sure how 139 created those corridors, where they received their information. So that would be something to look at. Don, am I missing anything?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, as Ben said, we're still reviewing the bill. The number one thing that comes out to me is that the bill is exclusive to AGDC and the ASAP project and not a pipeline in general. And once we conclude our analysis, we can present our findings to the committee at a later time.
Great. We will be holding this bill over, and so that would be great if you could have that available for our next hearing. Senator Stoltz, follow-up?
Yeah, following up on that, your statement about whether something needs to be in there, and I assume that's in conjunction with a pipeline project, AGC or ASAP, that's certainly a more objective whether or not it should be in there. That seems to be more objective. This, the latter is more subjective, and I think it doesn't recognize legislative prerogatives on what should be in there. And I know on behalf of the Walker administration, you can put down your mandates and your must-haves and demands and so forth. And certainly as a legislative body, we have our prerogatives. This looks like a pretty bit easy backhaul for some issues that have been languishing in parks. But I know for sure the governor will sign this one.
So we are looking forward to that comparison, and you can hear that we're pretty concerned that parts aren't left out again. So, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Do you see any, and it looks like a lot of this tracks along the roadway, but some of it veers off, and do you see any impacts to hunting or ability to use firearms?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, there will definitely be impact on hunting and firearms within the near the corridor, wherever that where it is, whether it's in the right of way, it wouldn't have any effect. If it goes into the park, there would be some. So yeah, yes, there would be some negative impact as far as the use of firearms in the area. I would have to check with Fish and Game as far as the right of way, as far as how far from the pipeline hunting or the firearms would be allowed. That would, I would assume, be in their purview.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Do you see any businesses or other properties being taken by eminent domain with the passage of this bill?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I do not. But we also have, I think, the Department of Law present, and that might be a question for the Department of Law.
Is Department of Law present?
Yes. Oh. Madam Chair, if I could, John Hudson with Department of Law would like to raise a point of clarification.
Yes.
As well as possibly address that.
Please bring a chair forward or switch out. Welcome.
This is John Hudgens of the Department of Law, so to the chair, to Senator Wilkowski. As far as eminent domain, I think that's actually probably more a question for someone involved with the pipeline projects. There are several private inholdings within the state parks, and once a final alignment is settled on, the question is, will that go through a private holding? The bill itself requires the state to exercise eminent domain if it's going to be exercised, and I'd point out that in several of these parks, eminent domain is actually not authorized. The state is required to purchase land rather than take it through eminent domain. So I think it's unlikely that there will be any takings using eminent domain within the parks. I also wanted to clarify something that may be a confusion. The corridor that's identified in this bill is not actually the final right-of-way. This is a corridor of land through which leasing would be authorized. This is, the legislature would be giving back to DNR the power to authorize at least somewhere within this corridor. The final construction corridor that Mike Thompson was talking about and the final operating corridor that Mike Thompson was also talking about would be some small segment within the legal description that you have before you. The description is just part of the park through which the pipeline would be authorized. The bill, the Tallarico bill that you discussed earlier, takes a different approach. It actually authorizes leasing throughout the park. There is no set corridor that pipeline could be issued, actually would be required to issue, be issued anywhere within the park where the application is made.
Follow-up, Senator Welikowski?
And maybe, I know the chair asked a question on which was preferable. Do you, from a legal standpoint, have a preference on which approach is preferable?
I think that's entirely a policy question. The legislature is certainly authorized to open this land for leasing. The governor's bill takes a more minimalist approach and identifies a corridor within which we believe the lease will be issued and within which the lease is authorized to be issued. The downside to that, obviously, is that there's some uncertainty about where the pipeline will finally cross. The upside is you're not opening the entire park to right-of-way leasing. Policy issue.
Senator Costello, did you have a question?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you. So if I understand correctly, this sort of sets just a general guideline of where the area, you know, would be, but would we have to then come back and replace this legislation or change it in any way, or will it essentially just be sort of a building block for the pipeline at which some point we will know the specific route?
Through the chair to Senator Costello, the answer is no, the legislature would not have to come back. This sets an area through which leasing is authorized for 10 years until January 1st, 2020. Right. The lease will be issued, and whatever the lease is what the lease will be. The only reason the legislature would have to look at it again is if the pipeline were in some dramatically different position so that leasing is actually not authorized for that land under this bill.
Yes, Senator Costello.
I was a little disappointed in your answer to Senator Wilikowski's question, so I guess I'll ask it again. So is there then a practical difference between saying we know this is the area, it could change, it may not specifically be where, you know, the pipeline itself can change. So in the Tallarico version, it sort of is a blanket approach saying leasing is allowed, and we will then obviously keep this to germane to the pipeline itself. So from a legal standpoint, what is the difference between this approach and the other approach that we haven't seen yet?
Through the chair to Senator Costello, I think that's a fairly complicated question. I think from a legal perspective, one advantage of taking the approach that the governor's bill takes is that if there were a challenge to a lease that was granted, the legislature has actually looked at this particular corridor and made a decision that right-of-way leasing is authorized within this particular corridor. And so that would limit review of the courts by the courts of that decision. If if a different bill with a much broader scope for leasing were authorized, then there would be a lot of particular circumstances associated with a route that the legislature hasn't looked at because it hasn't been identified, and that would leave that decision open to potential legal challenges depending on the facts of the particular route. From my perspective as a lawyer, that may be the most important difference. There are obviously policy issues that also distinguish the two approaches.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. And I suspect, Madam Chair, the Assistant Attorney will probably get a more defined view of what the administration's preference is after they talk to him again and get more clear marching orders, because obviously the governor has a bill, and I think he's already stated his defined preference. So I had a question for Mr. Ellis about stakeholders. Previously we had discussion of stakeholders. Division of Parks, that's a very common term, stakeholders. Can you just broadly define some of what you believe the stakeholders are in this process from your division standpoint and what discussions you had with them, just so we don't have to play catch-up with this later?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, Ben Ellis, Director of Parks. At this point in time, as far as this bill is concerned, we have had no discussions with stakeholders on this process. I believe during the EIS of a previous rendition, there were meetings held in the Talkeetna, Trapper Creek area, and maybe other places where individuals made comments. I'm in the process of getting those comments, so I know what they are. In this case, the stakeholders as far as Alaska State Parks would be considered to be various user groups in the area, businesses. We have an advisory board for the Matsu area, which this falls into. All of the areas with the exception of Captain Cook State Park, and that would be on the Kenai Peninsula. We don't have an advisory group for that particular area. So those would be the stakeholders that I would be kind of looking at.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the definition of who our partners are.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ellis, I just, perhaps you can come back. You left something out there on the record that I'm not sure is entirely correct, and that's not a problem. This isn't the first high-pressure natural gas pipeline that's gone through a state park. You made the statement that firearms may not be allowed on the right-of-way. Could you please do the research on that and come back? I think you might have a different answer.
Thank you, sir.
And I think it's a pretty important answer that stakeholders, it is open to traditional uses, except in very specific cases like during construction and such. But I don't want to give an absolute answer. I think that's your job. So we could cover that again.
Thanks, sir. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, and you're correct, I was in the thought of the construction stage, that there would be some limitations there. But as far as this is an underground pipeline, it will be revegetated. I even see some recreational opportunities from this. So, yes, sir, I'll get back.
Madam Chair.
Yes. I think Mr. Perrin also wanted to respond to your question, Senator Machicki.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, I would add that through the remainder of the current right-of-way that exists, the 38-35 on state lands, the hunting analogy is the same. Folks access and hunt along those non-park lands, and so the analogy would be the same in the park as outside the park. If you need access along the pipeline right-of-way, the analogy is going to be the same whether you're in the park or you're out of the park. And so we will do the research, and I agree with you on that. We need to clarify that.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator?
I do. Just under 49 CFR Part 192, they're also required to maintain the right-of-way. So actually what you find is somewhat improved access in many situations. So I just thought the public may want to know that if they're worried about being shut off from a 800-mile swath of property. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Walikowski.
Yeah, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the improved access. And if this is going through wetland areas, is it likely that this will be converted into an area that you can now walk and maybe ride an ATV on?
Through the chair, Senator Walikowski. I think premature to say what we can do. I mean, that would be the intent. To use sort of the rails for trails model, where old railroad beds were turned into hiking trails or ATV trails or snow machine trails. What we can do, I think, is still let's see exactly where it is and what issues we have to deal with and what level of restoration is to go back. Then we can maybe look at the recreational opportunities.
Good. Well, we are reaching the close of our meeting time. I do intend to hold the bill over. I know senators want to examine this more closely. I think they'd probably like to visit with Director Ellis and Mr. Perrin, probably with some more specific questions. So we will hold it over and have you back again. I want to thank you for being here, as well as Mr. Menifee and all the folks at AGDC. So at this time, this will conclude our meeting for today. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, March 11th. We're going to be looking at oil and gas development in what is called Middle Earth, checking out what we've been doing there. So at this time, I will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5 p.m.